Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. So we've had a chance to meditate for 24 hours. So as I say, if it's been easy, the time has gone quick. It's been difficult, the time has gone slow. But I think in meditation you do get a sense of a kind of timelessness because you're not bound by. Well, we do have a routine, but you're not trying to produce anything, get any kind of a result. Hopefully not. And the mind becomes kind of timelessly present. And time and self are very synonymous. My memories, what I did in the past, where I'm going in the future. And yet we can only know the present moment. Can only know time as we have chronological time, but you can only know memory in the present moment. You can only know anticipation in the present moment. So it's kind of a paradox, isn't it? We live in chronological time, but we can only know the present moment. And these to the two ways I think the Buddhist teaching is set up is one is a life in chronological time, a conventional life of, as I was saying, morality and responsibility and just the way we live our lives according to our diaries and our calendars and what we do. And then there's this curious different aspect where there's always the sense of timelessness and presence, which you don't get it by producing a whole bunch of results. Like you don't get presents like baking a cake. You bake a cake, you put the ingredients in. I've never baked a cake, by the way. But I have an imagination. Then you put in ingredients and then you get a result, right? In time, in chronological time. But presence is not the same, is it? It's not like you do something now in order to be present at 4:15 tomorrow. Like you kind of accumulate a whole bunch of results and then boom, there's presence. It's always here and now. That's the kind of curious part about it. And so that's what I've been emphasizing more on this retreat. I haven't been emphasizing conventional teaching and truths like morality and social responsibility. Those I think you're all pretty good at. So go for it, as they say. But this other part, and that's where my curiosity lies. I live a very fortunate conventional life as a monk. I'm very fortunate to be able to live like that, and I try to do that well. But what motivates me as a sort of spiritual life is the sense of presence and that which is timeless, that which is not bound by conditions, that which is not dependent on happiness and unhappiness, that which is not reach through analysis, that which is not an experience in the same way as hot and cold are experiences. That's where my curiosity lies. So that's what I'd like to talk about. But the conventional is very important. If the conventional life is confused, then it's very hard to touch those other aspects because the mind is just preoccupied with regret and remorse. So on. So here in a retreat, what we do is we simplify everything. So we practice renunciation, practice non-distraction, you know, it's very simple, not too complex, and that gives us the freedom to just practice presence, 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 presence. See what happens. What happens if you do that? I came across a very lovely phrase, the satisfaction of competence. Really nice one, isn't it? When you do a teach retreats all the time like this, you find these little gems, like satisfaction of competence. And think about it, the way we go beyond doubt, say. It's not just by having an idea. So think of a potter who does potting for a lifetime and has this competence through experience, through trial and error, through learning about different materials, or a therapist has competence through struggling with clients and struggling with self-doubt, and an engineer has competence, and so on. So we gain competence by doing things, and then there's a satisfaction in that, isn't there? There's a sense of, yeah, I can do this. And it's not conceit. It's not conceit. It's a kind of fulfillment of the heart. And that fulfillment of the heart then settles the mind, I think. And it's very true in meditation too, that, or the whole Buddhist path, is that there's a competency that comes about through the training, through the doing, through the studying, through the experimenting, through the failing, and all the rest of it. And that competency then is hard won, isn't it? It doesn't come to that, at least not to me at least. It didn't come very easily. It just came through a tremendous amount of struggle and error making and willfulness and laziness and all the rest of it that we human beings get up to. So it's a hard one, competency, but the satisfaction is very, very deep, because it's a kind of satisfaction that no longer depends on accomplishing objective goals, like doing something objective that other people are judging, or that the world judges, or that you need other things to gain that satisfaction. The satisfaction of meditation and contemplation is this kind of inner confidence and inner stillness. Yeah, this is the path. This is worthy, and this is meaningful. And that, I think, is how we go beyond doubt in the spiritual life. Not just through intellect, but competency and intellect is important too. So that the combination of understanding the teaching at an intellectual level, understanding like how to practice, and seeing that the results of practice are fruitful, all that comes together both intellectually, emotionally, socially, and I think spiritually, the kind of the transcendent. And that's I think, something that can't really be taken away from us either. Like I can be I can be an athlete and my knees can be taken away from me. Or I can be a I can drive a car, and then at the age of 80 they take my license away. You can think of all kinds of things that are dependent on other externalities, but the competency and the satisfaction of meditation is something that is always ours, because it's based on insight and it's based on work we've done within ourselves, and that's the work we're doing here. So even if you have a difficult time or things don't seem to be coming together, whatever, that sincerity of just going back to your inner world and saying, well, what is it? What's the problem? Why am I suffering? Why is there not contentment? What is the thing I'm resisting, or what's the problem? And that's very much the Buddha's genius, is that he took that human yearning for going beyond problems to finding something which is profound. He took that yearning and that honesty that we have, and he said that very discontent, that sense of lack that you have, that's the key, isn't it? That's the key. Because if you are willing to go into that, into the pain or the sense of lack or the dissatisfaction, it takes you much, much deeper than pleasure does. Pleasure is pleasurable, and pleasure has its uses, aesthetic pleasure. So we have a lovely shrine room and we have a lovely environment. That has its uses, doesn't it? Sorry. Dawn and I were, I must have confessed, we were talking at tea time and just saying how silent it is here. And just coming in the morning sittings, and that's pleasurable, and it's uplifting, and it's helpful. There's nothing wrong with that. But there's something peculiar, something particularly edifying about being with pain and being with lack and being with whatever kinds of confusion we face, and like really going into it, and observing it and being with it. That brings you a deeper sense of competency and a deeper sense of fulfillment. Because the very nature of pain and discontent is that we seek objects. You know, we seek objects of compensation and distraction. And that's all right too, but as long as our relief from pain or relief from lack is always through getting something else, then there's no end to it. There's no real fulfillment. But when we have a sense of lack, And we're willing to make that fully conscious, that's a kind of very mature mind, isn't it? When we have a sense of discontent or a sense of failure or a sense of betrayal or a sense of loneliness, or you have your own list, I'm sure. And we're willing to make that fully conscious and be with that. And notice the desire to move away from it and the desire to move into other objects, to distract, but we stay with that, then that brings us to what we call nirodha, or the cessation of suffering, or the cessation of desire, the cessation of craving. And that cessation, that is a kind of fulfillment of the heart, because we find freedom or peace not in an object, but in being at peace with all objects. And that's the sort of model that the Buddha presents to us. That objects themselves are okay, but no object can fully, no object can be fulfilling. No person, no emotion, no monastery, no teacher, no type of cake. You know, it's always limited. But it's not bad. It's not bad. Beauty's not bad. Pleasure is not bad. It's not like Buddhism is a sort of down on pleasure and some up on pain. Oh, let's just have more pain. Because if it was that, then, you know, well, I'd make you sit here for 10 hours and you'd leave in 45 minutes. So it's not about inflicting pain or having more pain or kind of being in it, you know, just exacerbating pain, but it's going to the heart of discontent and just seeing that awareness contains that. Awareness is bigger than that. And that's a kind of courageous and patient thing to do. So the way the teaching encourages us to is to take the stream of consciousness, first of all, and begin to observe it as just a stream of events, as opposed to our conventional life. So forget about the sense of self and me and all of that. We just see it as feelings and thoughts and emotions and memories. Just try to see it in a very bare way. Memory is memory. Bodily feeling is bodily feeling. And just begin to observe that movement and see how things change, how they arise and they cease. And so that's pretty easy when it's neutral. Kind of easy, but you can float off, of course. But as soon as you hit a bump, like something painful, then it's very hard to be with that. very hard to be with that. And so the Buddhist teaching is, well, can you refocus on discontent? Can you just make it fully conscious? And that's really what the First Noble Truth is about, understanding suffering, making it conscious, letting it come into consciousness, letting it be there. Now, most humanity doesn't want to do that, I think. Most humanity just wants to distract or blame. So it takes, I think, quite a... It's a very mature thing to do, isn't it? Buddhism. It's not. And it's a tough teaching. It's like there's no one going to do it for you, and there's no excuses. Right? So even though I might get betrayed by someone or whatever, still, if I hold on to that, everyone might agree, yeah, it's awful, Viradhamma, you got betrayed. But still, if I hold on to that, I get the karmic result of that, which is revenge or awfulness of some sort. So it's a kind of whatever happens, you got to work with it. If you don't, you're going to pay the price. And that's, it sounds a bit heavy maybe, but it's true, isn't it? So say, in my own life, I've had situations where I certainly felt like I've been done wrongly or whatever. And as long as I held on to those and didn't make them conscious, I got more and more confused. But when I could just stop and say, "So what's the problem? What is it? What is it? Why can't you just, what are you running? Why are you distracted? What's going on?" That kind of, yeah, I'm going to hold this thing now and look at it. When there's been that, there's a kind of relief, isn't there? Yeah, oh, okay, I'm really with it now. The pain or the sorrow, it was just physical pain, say. Pain in the knees. So like we had a nice long sitting this afternoon, and I could just see the kind of restlessness of discomfort and not really making it conscious. You're just sort of being there but not being there. And then what is it? What's the resistance? So non-resistance, and I make conscious resistance. So when I say non-resistance, make conscious resistance, and what is it? And that's that kind of awakening, really looking at something very directly. And it's amazing how that's an easy idea, but somehow we're just sort of not with it, aren't we? There is resistance, and we know there's resistance, but we don't make it conscious. We're kind of really not with it. So that idea is very, very strong in Buddhism. Make conscious the way things are. Let it become fully conscious the way things are. Which isn't a judgment, it's not analysis, it's a real opening of the mind, a welcoming of things into consciousness. Because when you can make them conscious, then you begin to know them as objects. They're no longer the subject. You just take something like discomfort and waiting for the bell to ring. We all have that, don't we? Sort of comfort. You sort of, you know you're feeling discomfort, but you're kind of thinking, oh, when is it going to end? And there's resistance and then... And you're kind of not there, and then the bell rings. Oh, good, I'm out of here and go for a walk. But then, like in that resistance, you just make a determination. Now, what is it? What is this moment really about? And that's that full awakening to life, full awakening to life. And actually, that's the path. You've done it. You're there. You forget next minute, maybe, but that's it. You're there. You're on the path again. So the language of awareness and mindfulness is kind of encouraging us to continue return to this refuge of Buddha knowing Dhamma again and again and again and again a million times. The kind of things we experience as human beings sometimes, yeah, things kind of go along real nice, sometimes they fall apart. So like social life, monastic life. For me, sometimes I think the monastery is kind of, wow, this is working. And then I think, God, how did I ever end up in Perth? I really do sometimes. I mean, my gosh, it's the northern edges of humanity. So I go, yeah, I had it almost like this. I go to Thailand, right, and it's like 60 million Buddhists, and maybe two non-Buddhists in the country. It's some ridiculous percentage. So I said, this is really easy, being a monk in Thailand. And then I go to Perth, and I like it there, but sometimes I think, ooh. And one morning I woke up and I went, what have I done? This kind of deep despair. My God, you're a Dhammo. This was this year. I mean, you're 67, and you've started another monastery. You idiot! You could be retired. You could be, this kind of voice came up in me, which was saying, "You dummy! You know how much responsibility you have. All these blah, blah, blah. And I just felt this kind of dread. This kind of deep, deep dread in my heart. Right? It wasn't really logical or rational, but it was real. It was really, really real. And, monastery is a lot of responsibility, people, and like a senior monk has to tell people what to do. I don't want to tell people what to do. I don't care what they do, basically. Do what you want, man. But if I don't, it's even worse disaster. So I have responsibilities. It's called training monks. So then I wake up in the morning, it's a horrible feeling. Oh. And I said, no way, Mara. I'm going to watch you. And I watched her for 5 minutes and it finished. And I don't know, that's right practice. And it was, and that's the kind of the satisfaction of competency. You know, Mara comes at you with all those terrible voices, and it seems very, and it is real, you know, at some level. It's real in the sense you feel it, maybe not rational, but it's certainly real. And no way, I'm just going to be fully conscious of this and not run with the thoughts. And then I came to breakfast. I love the people there. It was a great breakfast. Walked around, it looked great. Got a new building, have a shower. Very nice. And that kind of competency of the skills of the contemplative is very rewarding, isn't it? It's very rewarding. And it's in the midst of that stuff that blows us away or that confuses us. It's right in the midst of that where your competency is tested. And then your competence is proved. And I think all of us see that, don't we? You know, you think about how unmindful I was when I started as a monk, when I started this path, and things I've been through, and you can see, yeah, there are results. Now sometimes the results aren't, you read the Zen story where the Zen monk gets hit in the head with a piece of bamboo and he's enlightened, right? So you think, I want that one. So, still hitting your head with it. And you think there's some kind of big explosion is going to happen. But actually I think the just those little insights that one has, just the little inklings of truth that come up, and they add up. They really do add up into a life which is as competent in the spiritual path. So I would really encourage you that you've all developed skills in the path. In your meditation, and don't worry about the rubbish that comes up into mind. You know, the kind of things like I had that morning. And that's not who you really are. That's just old karma coming through. As I say, old gas coming through the head. But have confidence more in what refuge really is. Refuge, the kind of idea that Buddhists have that the awareness of the way things are really is a refuge. Nothing else is. Everything else is changing. And the perception of change itself is enlightenment. Because when I knew that emotion, when I just made the determination, that's just an emotion. I knew it as an object. That's enlightenment itself. Because there's no delusion there. It was unpleasant. Unpleasant. And then the rewards of that come afterwards. So one is enlightened to anicca dukkha anatta. One is enlightened to through the perception of change. I've been kind of rereading Ajahn Chah, you know, in the monastery we have, after breakfast we have a meeting, a kind of business meeting, and then afterwards we usually have a reading. And I've been reading Ajahn Chah's teachings, and I hadn't gone back to them for quite a long time. And what really struck me about the thing I'm reading now is his, even as a young, you know, as a young monk, he was a city monk and a townie. And in the city monasteries, town monasteries, quite often there's no meditation. It's mostly just study and ritual. And it can be kind of very intellectual, say, or just very, very cultural. But Ajahn Chah had this kind of, right from the get-go, he really wanted to practice, even though around him there wasn't that kind of practice much. And just reading it, he was always using this perception, it's uncertain. And many of you have read his work, and he's just, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. And what struck me about reading that is he wasn't just taking the kind of the Buddhist party line, this is changing, but he was actually using that perception constantly on all his mind states, all his social situations. It's uncertain, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. And that's the power of perception as a method rather than an idea as a conclusion. An idea as a conclusion or an affirmation is that we all agree that that which is born dies. That which has a nature to begin has a nature to end. Anicca. So we've heard that a million and one times as Buddhist practitioners. But to actually take that and then apply it 24/7, that's the method. The former is an agreement, not wrong, not wrong, correct by nature, but it doesn't really liberate you. It can, you know, it can ease things, but what really liberates is the use of that perception, moment by moment by moment by moment, because each time you can apply that perception, this is uncertain or this is changing, your mind lifts off the khandhas. It's not grasping the khandhas. Because to do that, you have to not be preoccupied with it. So if I'm, let's say I'm feeling, I wake up in the morning and have this kind of horrible emotional state come into my mind. If I have the presence of mind uncertain, what does that do to that particular mood of mind? Well, it puts it in perspective as an object, uncertain. But the feeling at that moment was this as reality. You know, the feeling was very, very powerful. This is very, very true. In some sense, it was true. You know, you could say it was true, but actually the feeling was very, very powerful. But as soon as I could say, this is uncertain, this is changing, that's a method. It's not a kind of conclusion. I could say, oh, this will change, yeah, but just know it's uncertain. As soon as I say that, I see it as an object moving through consciousness. I see flow of consciousness now, and I am no longer that flow. I'm no longer the subject of that. I'm the witness, the awareness of change. And that's enlightenment. That's the Buddha. This is the way Ajahn Chah would teach. When you see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. You see the Buddha, you see the Dhamma. And that's Dhamma, is that which has a nature to rise has a nature to cease. But to apply that all the time, is a practice, is a method, is something that's, some areas of life it's very hard to do because we're just sort of, you know, we're caught up in on our conclusions or judgments or whatever it might be. And that really struck me in reading how right from the start, Ajahn Chah was uncertain, it's uncertain, it's uncertain. Now this isn't doubt. It's not like doubting, oh, I'm uncertain about life. It's a perception that you keep applying. And the analogy I always give is if you have, you know, the one we do is the glass is half empty or the glass is half full, right? So that's, to see a glass is half empty is a perception. To see the glass is half full is a perception, half empty, half full. But the effect on the mind, one is a pessimist, one is an optimist, I suppose, or one is a realist or whatever. And so if someone wanted, if someone was very cynical and skeptical and whatever, and saw that as a really unfortunate habit, and they started to half full as a perception that they brought up deliberately, that would help them see the world in a different way. But the habit of, oh, it's half empty, it's half empty, it's half empty, would still be quite powerful. So they'd have to keep doing that, and they have to keep applying that perception if they wanted to maybe go beyond their cynical mind. That's a kind of a nice example of that. Same with the perception of change or the perception of self. Like the way I've been talking about how to maybe do anatta as a perception is this is taking place in awareness. So that feeling is in awareness. That awful feeling is in awareness. And when I do that, and if you do that, there's no longer me suffering that thing, but that thing is an object. When I'm caught and attached to it and thinking through it, and my thoughts are driven by it, then it's me. Oh, what am I going to do and what's going to happen and so on. That's, but then you change the perception from me being in the head and having a problem to the, this is in awareness. Now that, you have to do that, don't you? You have to do that. You have to change the perception. This is in awareness. And that's not a normal perception we have. Now this is also not like a philosophical belief. Some people say, oh, you're saying that awareness is a universal consciousness enclosing all beings, supreme enlightenment, something like that. That's just a thought. You know, this is kind of philosophical conclusion, or you can agree to disagree, but that's not it. It's like using a perception constantly, constantly, like really applying your mind and to interpret life in a different way. And so if I do that, like it's just like with the body, say. The body starts to hurt, and I bring up that perception that pain is in awareness. Pain is in awareness. Then that tendency of me having pain, worrying about pain, and so on, falls away, and there's just pain. And it becomes much more neutral. So the same with perception of change. That's something that one needs to apply. This is changing. This is uncertain. And you can only see if that works if you do it. And so that's what the teachings on the three characteristics that we chanted this morning on the five khandhas. These three characteristics, unsatisfactory, changing, not self. That's the method of enlightenment. That's the method of enlightenment. It's not just the Buddhist conclusion. You know, it's not like an agreement we all make and then do something else. It's very alive that way. It's very, very alive. So whichever of those three perceptions you want to pick up, the perception on dukkha, the word dukkha, as I've often said, is the word for suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And that's used in Pali in various ways. One is, there's dukkha vedana. I think I talked about this last year, but it's an important concept. Dukkha vedana is the feeling of unpleasantness that we have. And then dukkha satcha is the first noble truth of suffering, discontent. But dukkha lakkhana, the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, is that you won't find the transcendent in any condition. So you get to this point, it's not that. It's not a sight, it's not a sound, it's not a smell, it's not a bodily feeling. And what does that take you? It takes you to awareness. Not this, not that. There's different ways we talk about that. But I think the important thing is to see how do you use the Buddhist teaching, and this particular teaching, as a perception or an idea that you apply constantly and see if that works. See how that might be effective. Uncertain. Now this is very, very good, like when you're making judgments about people or yourself, it's a very good one to use. You know, you get this really judgment, you're sure that this person is really like that. Uncertain. Uncertain, very, very helpful. Some judgment you make about yourself, uncertain. And you can still have judgments, but you begin to just say, well, that's something that has arisen. And it kind of frees your mind. You have a much better, especially if you're getting angry at someone, or a third party comes. That's what I get. I get, monk A talks about monk B, tells the abbot that monk A did this, and then I can feel, he did what? You know, be careful, it's uncertain. Third party information is deadly. I've been burned by that one so often in monasteries. And I mean, that's a kind of saving one, isn't it? It's uncertain. So to see if you can, so one just kind of to sum up is like, there's the conventional way that we live our lives, right? And then there's looking at life as stream of consciousness. We're doing both. And then in stream of consciousness, what we're trying to notice is that the things arise and cease, and then in the knowing of change, you begin to intuit the changeless, the unchanging, or the transcendent. You begin to move towards the peace of consciousness which is not dependent on experience and objects. You have to wait for it. Because if that kind of suggestion, there's a kind of deep peace in the heart. What happens is you think, oh, if I just notice change and I'll find that deep peace. And then you're looking for an object called deep peace and you're done. Because it's not an object. So we say you are enlightened. You are peace. You are the unconditioned. In a way of using it, it's more like the Hindu way of talking. Non-becoming in Buddhism, non-becoming. All right, I'll leave that for your reflection. So,
the mayam dhamma kataya sadukaram dhamma se
sadhu sadhu sadhu.